From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We're all looking for something. All of us. Some of us are seeking God. Others, fame and fortune. But Hmong teenager Dao Chang was looking for something you can usually find close to home. Her mother.
As I was growing up, my dad didn't rarely speak of my mom. All he said was that she was really ill when we were living in the camps, and then she just passed away because she was sick, and that's really about all that I know about her death. Growing up without a mother, it's like growing up missing something in your life, and I don't know what it is that missing part is. We actually have 3 family photos and 1 portrait of her. The photograph is black and white, and she's wearing like a head wrap, like a traditional head wrap that Hmong women wear in the old country, and she's not smiling, and she's just looking at the camera. When you look at a picture like that, if nobody told you it was your mom, you wouldn't even know who it was. It'd just be a picture of a woman. I wanted to go back to Laos because my dad talked so much about it, and I knew that if I went back and saw this lifestyle, maybe I might have an idea of what my mother's lifestyle is. The best moment I had was when I was with my aunt and when she did take me to the place where our old village was. That journey there was really difficult. We drove on this half-paved road with a lot of potholes. There were straw huts and stuff. And although it was like kind of heartbreaking because, you know, it wasn't really anything, I got to see for myself what, like, this place that we all used to live there. It was really priceless, I guess. We actually sat down that night around the campfire, and my aunt, told me a lot about her. She says that I am really different from my mom. My mom is more, she's a lot thicker than I am, like she's not as lean, and just her characteristic, you know, everyone loved her. She was always a really happy person. She greets people wherever she meets. It made me feel like I'm getting to know this person that I didn't know, like this person that I'm supposed to know. It made me feel better about who she is and what I could have had if things were different. I don't just have a picture of who this person is anymore. I have like a whole person. I don't know if that makes sense. Like instead of just the picture, I have like the person also. So it became more real. Like, my mother is my mother, not just a picture that I carry around in my mind.
Dao Chang is a Hmong filmmaker who lives in Two Rivers, Wisconsin. Her documentary about the search for her mother is called My Way Home. You can see some of it on our website, ttbook.org. This hour on TT Book, we're talking with seekers, people who are looking for something. Some are seeking escape. Some are seeking connection. Some are looking for peace. War correspondent Laura King spent 3 years working as the Afghanistan bureau chief for the LA Times. Steve Paulson talked to her a few days after she returned home to the United States.
Did the violence become less shocking for you the longer that you were there, the more of it you saw?
Yes, I think so. And actually, that was one of the things that started to seem a little bit dismaying to me toward the end of my tour there, which was 3 years. I felt that there were things that should have been more shocking and should have been more distressing that instead just kind of started to register as information. And I didn't like that.
Can you give me an example of that? I mean, how things changed for you from when you first got there to how you were processing this kind of thing 3 years later?
Just the seeing the vulnerability of the human body in in connection with something like a suicide bombing. I think it's not something that you want to get over or get past, but you kind of have to psychologically.
Mm-hmm. So it was just it had become less shocking to you after you'd seen a lot of this.
Yes, yes. I mean, it does become routine to an extent, and that's a terrible thing to say. But you see something and you're kind of trying to estimate the size of the explosion and the number of casualties that were likely involved. And yes, I mean, I would say you are reacting a little bit less as a person being horrified by this sight and a little bit more as somebody who's just trying to put together what happened and make some kind of sense out of it.
You recently returned from Afghanistan after living there, being stationed there for 3 years. What was it like for you to leave and to come back to the United States?
Well, it was certainly a matter of mixed feelings to leave. There are so many people I still think about every day and remain in touch with. So I think it's as it would be leaving anywhere where there is turbulence and difficulty, that you feel bad for those that you're leaving behind. So I would say that was the predominant sentiment. I've actually been living in the UK since I left Afghanistan, and so of course all the comforts of Western life can seem quite incongruous. It's difficult to get used to all of that again.
What's been the strangest thing for you to come back to the developed world, to the Western world, after spending so much time in Afghanistan?
I guess just sometimes the sight of just people dressed in Western clothing, and I include myself. I mean, sometimes I'll put up my hand and feel my hair and think, oh, I went out without my headscarf. And then, that's not really something that I need to worry about at this point. But yes, I think just the manner of dress and the free interaction of men and women, that's all something to get used to.
So it sounds easier in many ways.
In many ways, yes. But I think that Afghanistan is one of those places that just really gets under your skin, and it's hard not to think about it and think about it often.
Hmm. Well, and it's also, of course, striking that, I mean, Afghanistan has been at war for years and years with various different countries, not to mention with, you know, internal factions. I mean, this is a country that just has not seen peace for decades.
Exactly. And so anybody under the age of 35 is going to have experienced just continual conflict and upheaval. And it was just always so striking to me when people would describe, oh, I was 10 years old when the Civil War happened and when the warlords were bombarding whole neighborhoods in Kabul. And then they would just segue right from there to the Taliban era and now to the current conflict. So yes, it's striking to me how sane so many people were able to remain in the face of that. I really can't think of another country that I lived in or covered where the level of upheaval and conflict was so continuous and so intense.
I'm curious about whether you had any particular reaction to the horrible shootings in the school at Newtown. I mean, given the kind of violence that you'd seen in Afghanistan, did that resonate with you in any particular way?
It did. I do find sometimes that even hearing from a great distance of some kind of violent incident like that, it really does just kind of give me this, well, as I think would be the case with many people, you just feel this sense of nausea. But I think it also makes me think, well, imagine living with that every day, as many Afghans do. Imagine any day you could wake up and something like that might occur. And that I think is the difference, that for us, we're fortunate in that it's an anomaly when something like that happens. But there, it's very much a part of the fabric of daily life, especially in the less secure parts of the country.
That's really interesting to hear you say that. I mean, that just seemed so off the charts. I mean, so extreme, so extraordinary. the violence in the Newtown shootings, and I guess it wouldn't be so extreme in Afghanistan.
Well, but what was actually very touching to me was that on the day that that happened, several of my Afghan acquaintances emailed and said, "Oh, we heard of what happened there in America, and we're so sorry. And are you all right? Are all your friends all right?" And that to me was just really extraordinary, that the people who live with what they live with every day could have this sense of sympathy and wanting to reach out.
What was the sweetest thing about coming home?
I would say just seeing family again. The technology has changed so much in recent years, and it's possible to stay in touch, you know, with Skype and video chats and everything else. But there really just isn't any substitute for being with the people you love.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything in particular you miss about Kabul now that you're not there anymore?
I would say just a few of the acquaintances and friends, the Afghan acquaintances and friends, really stay very vivid for me in memory, and I worry about them, and I wonder what is going to happen. I think it's just going to be such a fluid time for the next year or year and a half as more and more of the foreign troops leave, and it's just really not apparent whether the Taliban movement is going to step up the level of violence or work to become part of the political structure. It's just so hard to tell what's likely to happen and whether life is going to become even more difficult for people there.
You've written that every outsider spending time in Afghanistan comes away changed. How has it changed you?
Well, I think in ways that I'm probably still coming to grips with. It's difficult to know, walking away from it, and what the long-term effects are going to be. Overall, I would say I felt lucky to be there. I felt like it was a privilege to have the experience, and that feeling I don't think is going to go away.
For 3 years, Laura King was the Afghanistan bureau chief for the LA Times. She talked to us just days after she returned home. For me, the connection to home was always a letter. My folks used to write to me once a week. My dad used a typewriter, but when they were on vacation, it was my mom who wrote notes. They were handwritten. The test to tell who really belonged to the family was who can read Grandma Sally's handwriting. Well, we are putting together an hour on the art of handwriting, and how what's written down by someone you love can be incredibly precious, especially in an era when almost everything we do is typed on a computer screen. We'd love to hear your stories about handwritten things that have mattered in your life. What did you save? Love letters? Recipe cards from your grandmother? Letters from a soldier overseas? Notes from your kids? Send us an email and a photo, if you can, and we will choose some of you to be part of the show. You can send us your stories at ttbook@wpr.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Growing up, Kevin Shepard wanted to be a basketball star, to play in the NBA, be a household name, maybe get his name on a shoe. He set himself up to succeed, too, became a 2-time all-conference college player in Jacksonville. But he was never drafted to the NBA. So when a phone call came from Iran offering him a chance to go pro in the Middle East, he took it. After Anne Strangeshamp saw the documentary about Shepard called The Iran Job, she had to talk to him.
There must have been a moment when you thought, wait, do they even play basketball in Iran?
That's the first thing I said. As for the, you know, the first question I said to myself, do they even have basketball over there? I mean, is this a joke? Am I getting punked by Ashton Kutcher, one of these guys on MTV? So it was pretty unusual to get an offer from Iran.
The world now faces a grave threat from the radical regime in Iran. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil.
We will attack Iran. We would be able to totally obliterate them.
شپر تو برا ماده میکنه. چند ثانیه بیشتر نمونده شپر. میره به قصیم سمتیازی.
The culture over there was so different. Just coming from the American society, where I was at Jacksonville University playing for a legendary coach, U Durham, and everything had to be on time. I had to go to practice at 3 o'clock. It doesn't mean I show up at 3 o'clock. I had to show up an hour before, had to be dressed, because practice starts at 3, so you don't show up at 3. And then once I got over there, the first practice started at 8, the coach is coming in at 9:30, the players are walking in. I'm like, what is going on around here? I mean, it was like, what is this? I mean, it was like a whirlwind for me. I was like, man, this right here is crazy. You can just imagine. I was like, man, this ain't no basketball. I don't know what these guys doing over here.
In the meantime, you don't speak Farsi, and most of your teammates didn't speak English, so communication wasn't always easy. And then there were these big culture gaps. Like, there's this really funny story you have to tell when you decide one day that you want a Christmas tree. Yeah. But, of course, not only are you in the Middle East in a desert, but this is an Islamic country, and no one has any idea what you're talking about.
Yep. I mean, the fact of the matter is Abdullah, one of the most famous characters in the film, Afghanistan guy, who was my superintendent for my building, he helped me to get that Christmas tree. And the fact that he can't speak a lick of English and I don't know nothing about Farsi, now that I sit down and watch the film and I realize that every time I thought that I understand him, when I read the subtitles, we were so far apart. It was not even close. It was, you know, I wanted a Christmas tree. He thought I wanted marijuana, you know. So, like, so it was, oh, man, it was just some of the most hilarious stuff. But, you know, at the time, I thought he understood what I was saying. But he was like, no, that's illegal. That's illegal.
Billy, I need a Christmas tree. Christmas tree. Let me show you. You know, a little Christmas tree with a lot of lights on it.
You know, good cash.
Salam.
Oh yes,
dude. That's a flower shop.
This one? Oh, this one. Beautiful.
Are we in our way with a Christmas tree, Christmas tree, Christmas tree, we are in our way.
You spent your days playing basketball, but you also made some friends outside the team, and in particular with these three young women. How did you guys meet? How did you become friends?
Well, it actually started with Hilda, who is the team physical therapist, you know, and I actually got hurt in one of the games, so I had to go get some ankle, you know, treatment. And I met her. I was just yearning so much for English, somebody who just speaks English. I just said one day, I'm just going to speak and see if she understands me. And then she spoke English better than 90% of my team. My coach didn't even speak English. So that really grabs to me. And I was like, man, I have to start talking to this girl. Cause I just wanted to feel normal a little bit, being able to communicate on that type of level. And once I got opportunity to know her, and she got an opportunity to know me through the therapies and stuff, then she introduced me to her two other friends, Ilahe and Lale. You know, Ilahe became my English translator because she spoke English so well, even better than Hilda. And these young ladies were so educated that it just blew me away. So I just had to know more about them.
When you're hanging around, Kevin, when you were just sitting around with these women, because there were lots of evenings they'd come over and you guys would have dinner and talk, what kinds of things did you guys talk about?
You know, their lifestyles, what they go through, and their country, the government. We talk about our team. So we have a lot of subjects we do touch. But, you know, really the most interesting subject was the young ladies' lifestyle themselves, being the fact that they were so educated, they had their degrees. and the fact that they had a struggle within a struggle in their country because they were seen as second-class citizens to the men. So the fact that they didn't like wearing the scarves, you know, the fact that they couldn't protest and they couldn't be a witness against a crime unless they have two women to make one witness. This was very interesting to me because coming from America where women are so highly educated and they can go out there and be as successful as they can be, you know, make as much money as you want to be and just the sky's the limit in America. The fact that these highly educated women were just so restrained, it was really heartbreaking.
They told that this is some order from Tehran.
President of Iran, President Ahmadinejad, he said no more women can be at men's game, neither in football, nor basketball, nor tennis, nor hockey, nor nothing. All men's sports will be all men.
They make everything worse and worse and worse.
They can't do it.
They're crazy. We don't have any fun to do here. We don't have.
It kind of hurts me to see you girls go through what you go through. Because where we came from, we see women have so much power.
I don't believe in Islam because this fact of Islam that one woman is half of a man.
Just our government, our Sikh culture force us to... You should do this, you should do this. But the real Islam said that you should do whatever you like and there's no force to be in Islam.
I think I belong to here. If I go abroad, I may gain some freedom. They had revolution, they tried and they changed everything. But I prefer to stay here and change the situation here.
Was part of the connection between you guys that, you know, they're second-class citizens as women in Iran, and as an African-American in the U.S., you know, you've got to know what it's like to have your rights denied or to have to fight for them. Was that part of the common ground?
Definitely. I mean, I think I made that connection in the film. I made it many times to the young ladies as well because, you know, as an African-American, as you said, I can kind of relate to what they're going through. And seeing, so I think that's why we had such a strong connection because I share my views as well with them being an African American and what we had to go through in America to get, you know, the rights that we have today. The fact that, you know, we went through all the civil rights movements and all that, it was like a, I could say a parallelism or something like that, that these women were starting to get like that. I mean, they were starting to go out and protest. They were starting to make their voices be heard. Young ladies, like those three young ladies, was starting to go out there and holding up signs. You saw the green movement of what happened with the young lady that got shot, Nada. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the women themselves was really, you know, basically getting fed up with what was happening in the country. So,
but it's also important to understand that in Iran, single men don't have friendships like this with young unmarried women. I mean, you don't ride in cars with them. You certainly don't have them visit your apartment. Wasn't some of what you were doing
actually illegal?
So this was partly illegal, having these women over, but there was also, like, there's some connections going on between you, and there's one woman in particular. It seems like, I don't know, there's some sexual tension between you guys or just some really strong connection. What was that like?
When I talked to a lot of my teammates, most of my teammates, all they spoke about with the women was how many women they're going to have and basically how many wives they want to marry and, you know, who was, you know, the nicest guy talk, as you can imagine, that we probably can't see on the air. So you got to keep it clean. But in terms of the women, when once they find a person like myself who is willing to listen, first of all, who is willing to respect their opinion and who is willing to really speak to them on an intellectual level instead of a sexual level, I think that brought in some type of sexual attraction, if you can will, because they've probably never met someone like me. So you probably might see a little whiff of that, but in terms of any extra curriculum activities, I put it on the record, there was none.
Oh, okay, so you were a good boy.
Yeah.
You guys ever drink? You guys drink before? I know you don't drink.
Me not, but
you drink?
They, yes. You know, in our culture, mm-hmm. when we have some guests, mm-hmm. we offer
first.
Everything we, yes, to guests.
I'm sorry. You guys want some? I cannot give you and your girls liquor. They're going to lock me up.
Merci.
What about for those women in Iran? Is there going to be, you know, blowback or consequences for them once this movie comes out?
I don't know. I hope not. I hope that the women over there would, you know, I don't wish anything bad for anyone. But I hope when everyone get an opportunity to see the movie that they will realize that this movie is not about scoring any nation in terms of America versus Iran or anything like that. This movie is just to shed light on how people have to go through lives no matter what country you live in. You know, basically people is always going to be people, and we all have the same struggles and have to go through even, you know, some people got to go through even much worse situation than you. So the fact that myself was looking in the mirror and saying, wow, I can't believe I was so mad of not getting a PlayStation 2 and a PlayStation 3, yet these people over here are so highly educated and they can't even get the right to be themselves. So, you know, it sheds light in who you are and culturally, you know, especially right now with the economy in America, how everyone is really jostling to get the economy kickstarted. But, you know, compared to civil rights and human rights and what's going on over there, it's nothing close. I don't want to go through that. So I can only hope that this movie can inspire instead of divide. And I pray that nothing happened to those ladies over there.
So, Kevin, at the beginning of the film, you tell us that you never made the MBA and that was a disappointment to you. Since then, you've had experiences like this in Iran. I guess I'm wondering by now, do you feel lucky?
I mean, I feel more than lucky. I actually feel blessed. By just watching the movie, you can probably tell that I have something spiritual in me. And, you know, I do believe in God. And the fact that as every young man or anyone in America who's playing basketball, especially what I did at Jacksonville University, being two-time All-Conference player, your highest dream is to make it to the NBA. I mean, that's the only thing you see. And then I just flip gear and now I end up in Iran where it's supposed to be the weapon of mass destruction, and I'm seeing this type of culture from a people that a lot of people have no idea about. So it's a blessing because it changed so much things about me. You know, I try to look beyond what I see now on the news. I try to look beyond what I hear about people. You know, I try to investigate it for myself, and I think it only made me a better person, a more humble person, because I don't know, chances are if I probably made it to the NBA, I would have just been another athlete who probably make a lot of money, who everybody thinks is a superstar, and I probably wouldn't have never been this grounded. So the fact that I'm so grounded and I'm just so humble, you know, I thank God for that.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing the beauty.
This is just the truth.
Kevin Shepherd now runs a non-profit youth basketball league that tries to stem the violence in the U.S. Virgin Islands. You can find a link to the trailer for the Iran job on our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You have a nose for the new? You make fast decisions based on incomplete information? Lose your temper quickly? Bored a lot? Do you thrive in chaotic situations? You might be a born seeker, what science journalist Winifred Gallagher calls a neophiliac.
Basically, nothing reveals who you are more clearly than your habitual reaction to new things across many situations and over time. That really is the signature of your personality. So as a species, we are a neophilic species. All of us are better able to cope with change than other species. Within our species, however, we differ a great deal as individuals. I would say there are three basic types. The 15% of us who I call neophiliacs are characterized by an approach reaction to novelty and change. They love new things. They engage with new things. They love change. So these folks have tremendous advantages. They are energetic, enterprising. They have a lot of fun, and there are also drawbacks to that personality type. They can get into trouble. Being a neophilic endangers a lot of sobriety and marital fidelity and all kinds of other virtuous behaviors. At the opposite end of the extreme, there's another 15% of people who I call neophobes. And just like the neophiliacs have an approach reaction to novelty and change, neophobes have an avoid reaction to novelty and change. So these are people who like routine, they like things to be predictable, they like things to be safe as opposed to exciting. And then the 70% of us in the middle are the folks I call moderate neophiles. And of course, no one is totally average. Some of us tend more in the neophiliac direction, some in the neophobic direction. But the advantage of being in this very large moderate group is we don't have a knee-jerk habitual reaction to new things, either approach or avoid. We have a more moderate response of kind of, let me think about that.
Yeah. Well, you could put shy people in the middle there too, I suppose. People who sort of admire those who go out and get them but really can't figure out how to do it.
A lot of very shy people would be in the neophobic group, shy, sensitive people. The Emily Dickinsons of the world would be in the neophobic group. But you're actually touching on a really, really important point. There's no good or bad. It's not good or bad to be a neophiliac or a neophobe or a neophile. Each group has very important strengths and drawbacks. The neophobes, great poetry, Paradise Lost was not written by a neophiliac.
If it took was to be a neophobe to be able to write like Emily Dickinson, I'd be on it in a flash.
Well, had there been more neophobes in Wall Street boardrooms, we might have avoided a major recession. We need careful people who say, just because it's new doesn't necessarily mean it's good. Let's think about this. This looks kind of risky. We need some people like that. Just the same way we need people, the Steve Jobs of the world who lead forward and engage with the new and say, who cares if it's never been done before? Let's try it. We need that dialogue between those two groups at the extremes, and those of us in the middle are informed by those opinions, and hopefully that's results in a good way forward for the whole group.
I'd imagine that there's a lot of descriptors you could use for people in all of these groups, too. We're talking about seekers this hour on To the Best of Our Knowledge, and we think of those as the people who climb Mount Everest or swim the English Channel. I mean, they're pretty obviously neophiliacs, but what about somebody who's just interested in a new intellectual discovery, or who is searching for God? They can be in search of change just as much?
Oh, absolutely. People in research on temperament, the people who are extreme novelty seekers, the people who would score off the charts in these tests and in temperamental measurements of brain scans and all kinds of physiological measurements of novelty seeking, it's unlikely that they would only be interested in intellectual or spiritual development. They tend to be very robust across the whole range of activities. They like to climb Mount Everest and have a wild sex life and engage in all kinds of go to a different nightclub every night and try new kinds of investments. It's a very full-blown, high-energy, high-octane temperament. However, you could be a neophobic person. Thomas Edison was a very, very shy, very withdrawn, yet he was a, you know, a fantastic inventor. Eleanor Roosevelt is a classic. She was noted even as a little girl. Her nickname was Granny even when she was a little girl. She was so cautious, so shy by nature. Yet her family sent her when she was orphaned to go to a wonderful school in London that was run by a feminist headmistress who encouraged Eleanor to develop character and her mind and to reach out to other people. And this terribly shy person was able to transform herself into what Harry Truman called the First Lady of the World. So there are a lot of different ways you can go with these different temperaments.
Kids, when do we begin to see with kids what genetic makeup they may have as far as neophilia is concerned? Because you do see kids surrounded by toys saying, I'm bored, I don't want to do, there's nothing to do, and there are hundreds of things around them. Are they just looking for the new?
Well, your question really started back with when do we see these differences? We see them really at birth. Fascinating research. Newborns will stare for an average of 41 seconds at a new image. If you can imagine somebody showing little babies flashcards, that's what they do. And when the baby sees something that it hasn't seen before, he'll stare for 41 seconds. And then if you keep showing that same image to the baby will stop staring or just glance or look away. So we are attracted to new things right from birth. You know, 10 or 15% of the babies are just, if you pop a balloon or make a loud noise, some of them go, woo, wow, woo, great. And other ones go, wow, wow, ah. So it seems to, this approach avoid reaction to novelty seems to be something that's in our inborn temperament right from the very get-go, especially if you're at the one of the extreme ends.
When you're assessing adults, I have the impression that there's a series of questions that help you get there. Do you make decisions quickly based on incomplete information? That kind of thing. Is that true? Do you lose your temper? Is that an indicator?
Well, I would say, are you motivated more by hope of gain or fear of loss is a good one. Are you drawn to engage in or avoid risky activities? Do you switch with your job or your romantic partner or and your home, or do you like to switch around? Do you stick or switch? Are you impulsive or are you deliberate? Yeah, are you hot-tempered or even-tempered? Are you extravagant or frugal? Disorderly or tidy? Certainly any kind of overindulgence in terms of alcohol, food, drugs, drive speeding, all those things are indications as well.
All of those things, all of the answers to those questions are liable to the label of good or bad. And that's interesting in trying to look at this too, don't you think?
Well, I don't agree. I think it takes all kinds. I mean, that's how nature, unfortunately or not, nature does not guarantee the survival of the species within the individual. It guarantees our survival for the group. So nature wants a group to have some people going, uh-oh, I don't know. I don't know if we all should go black diamond skiing, and needs some other people saying, sure, come on, let's try it. It could be fun. That's adaptive. That, I guess, predators would be a better example. Nature would want some people to saying, oh, I don't know, there could be very dangerous predators over there on the other side of the river, and you need other people saying, no, we need to go over the other side of the river because we could get some wonderful new resources.
Well, and certainly then, if you look at our history, there's been a necessity for the neophiliac. We wouldn't have adapted without them.
Yeah, and it wasn't a bunch of neophobes who decided they would go to the moon, you know. I mean, we need these people. The SEAL Team 6, these are not neophobes. We need all kinds. We need SEAL Team 6 and we need Emily Dickinson. It's not an either-or situation.
Winifred Gallagher wrote New, Understanding Our Need for Novelty and Change. So have you figured out whether you're a neophiliac or maybe a neophobe? If you want some help with the analysis, take Gallagher's quiz. It's on our Facebook page.
For weeks, I had been searching for the great lost city, Ciudad Blanca. It is considered the El Dorado of Central America, and scores of explorers, adventurers, scientists, and government secret agents have pursued it for hundreds of years, all the way back to Christopher Columbus and the conquistador Hernan Cortez. Some died, many got sick or lost, or simply disappeared.
That's writer and adventurer Christopher Stewart reading from Jungle Land, a book about his search for the fabled lost city, Ciudad Blanca.
Douglas Preston, writing in The New Yorker, once described the lost city as among the unanswered mysteries of the world. Paul Theroux, in his novel The Mosquito Coast, doesn't mention it by name, but refers to a secret city in the Honduran jungle, inhabited by a secluded and enigmatic tribe called the Munchies. I'd never expected to come here. I'd heard the stories about how the vanished jungle metropolis might actually be the capital of a forgotten Mesoamerican civilization 2,000 or more years old. I'd heard other equally archaic stories about ghostly spirits that protect the ruins, indigenous people with ancient secrets, murderous gold prospectors, and an American spy who had claimed in 1940 that he had found the sacred place, only to die unexpectedly before disclosing the location. The last story ultimately pulled me into the jungle.
Thank you. Well, romance is great. Everybody loves a little romance, especially when you're sitting home in New York thinking about it, I guess. But then there are these the place to start, I think, really, is with the questions your wife kept asking you. What were you thinking? What were you looking for?
Yeah, she thought it was a bit crazy at first. But it gets back to this very human, I think, desire, this itch to believe that there are places out there. I mean, you know, look, I when I started thinking about this place, I had just settled down. I had just gotten married. I'd gotten a mortgage. I had a three-year-old. We moved out of the fast-paced Manhattan to the, you know, sleepier Brooklyn. And I, you know, stumbled across this lost city out there. And I just kept thinking to myself, God, wouldn't it be wonderful just to sort of step away from this life, this very comfortable life, and just see if it actually exists? She thought that was crazy, but in the end, I prevailed and left for the search.
But there's still, I think, the question of motivation to be talked about, because you're very clear that you're a New Yorker, you're a city guy, you don't even like camping very much.
Oh yeah, I was. In that way, it was absolutely insane. I think the last time I camped, I was 10 years old in my parents' backyard, and that doesn't really constitute camping. I don't much like trekking, you know, the idea of, you know, being outside for long periods in the rain and then sleeping in the rain. That's as attractive as traveling, I think, to Mars. But again, I think it was the idea of challenging myself. I kept coming back to is the romance of this disappeared place and the possibility of stumbling upon it. You know, people had been searching for hundreds of years for this place. This is El Dorado of Central America. And I thought, you know, the journals, I mean, ultimately it was the journals that led me there, led me to believe that there was a possibility of finding this place, and that was able to persuade my wife that it wasn't absolutely insane, but just partly insane.
Well, that's the essence, isn't it? I mean, it's not just the dream. It's not just the city of gold that you're running for. You came across something concrete, these journals of Theodore Moord. He was really the beginning of it all for you, wasn't he?
Yes. You know, it was just a disappeared lost city until I actually found out that there was this American spy in the 1940s who claimed he found this place. There were many stories written about his discovery, but the one missing piece was the location of it. We knew it was on Honduras, but he never disclosed the location. And he ended up dying after World War II, and with his death, his journals all disappeared. But I ended up actually tracking those journals down to his nephew's place in North Carolina, and there was lots of clues to where this place could be. And I thought, gosh, nobody's followed up since him, and I actually have some evidence here that this place could actually exist.
You must have, at moments when you got there, felt that this was an impossible quest, that we live in a world with satellites and planes that fly overhead and look at everything, and with these huge swaths of forest that had been cut down to nothing. I can imagine a little despair.
Yeah. There are many moments of despair where I was traveling through the jungle and just not believing, thinking that it was all such a big charade on his part. He was driving me out into the jungle on this fool's quest, particularly after, you know, a big, you know, 8 or 9 hour slog through, you know, through jungle with my, you know, feet blisters and rain coming down, and you know, and I was, you know, I was traveling with three guides who would, time to time would also say, you know, this is a little crazy. Do we really think that Moore had actually found anything? So yeah, there were many moments where I thought maybe we should turn back. You know, my guide got sick at one point. You know, we ran into some pirates at another point. My body felt pretty broken up, and I was ready to turn back. And not to mention my wife, who I got on the satellite phone once or twice, was a little worried too.
Still asking you why you were there.
Why are you there? And incidentally, it was my daughter's fourth birthday, so I was missing that. So the guilt was really started to gather.
So how did you decide where to go next? Because he did, or at least he swore he did, find the city. So you must have
right.
wanted to
so
go in the right direction.
We made our way down the river to the Indian villages that he visited and talked to them about this legend and about the people that had come looking for it. And we found an elderly man, one of the oldest Indians in the village that we were directed to, and, you know, asked him about Moore's story. And he told us that he remembered Americans coming through at that time. I didn't remember Moore's name specifically, but did talk about some ruins that were far up another river called the Wampu. Now, in Moore's journal, what's interesting is that, like the spy in him, there seemed to be places where he almost coded things into the journals. And he wrote in the journal, "No archaeological ruins up the Wampu," which seems strange because when I was traveling all over this area, people kept on talking about ruins up the Wampu. So we, of course, went up the Wampu.
And what did you find?
We found a fairly large archaeological site that was – I imagined going into this that I would see, you know, this sort of the Indiana Jones version of a city, you know, this – the pillars covered in trees and engorged in shubbery and, you know, the monkey gods that Moore had described, and just sort of walking into this place and thinking, wow, this is a city that's just sort of been swallowed up by the jungle. It's just totally covered by trees, but there's no pillars. It just looks like a carpet that's been upturned. And it's one of the things that I probably wouldn't have actually even seen it if it weren't for my archaeologist. It was Chris Bagley, who was traveling with me, who pointed out, you know, these 20 or 30 foot hills that were actually weren't hills. It was jungle that had covered these ruins.
Do you find you went there looking for adventure? You went seeking a trip that you could remember forever. Do you find yourself seeing the buildings rising out of that ruin?
Well, I stood there for, you know, a very long time, looking there, and I closed my eyes, and I could just, I had been journeying for so many weeks at that point that I wanted to see something, and, you know, you close your eyes and you can see it sort of rising up around you. As Chris Bagley put it, you know, the archaeologist traveling with me, I said, "Where is it?" And he said, "Just look around. It's everywhere."
Wow. Was it enough? Was this the adventure you wanted?
It was more than I wanted. You know, I look back on it romantically thinking, God, that was what a wonderful trip, you know. But there were very few moments where I was actually thinking on that trip, this is a beautiful thing. I'm so happy to be out here. Most of the time I was thinking, well, let's find this place. I just want to get out of here.
Christopher Stewart's book is called Jungle Land. This is a poem called The Seekers by John Masefield from 1910. Friends and loves we have none, nor wealth, nor blessed abode, but the hope of the city of God at the other end of the road. Not for us are content and quiet and peace of mind, for we go seeking a city that we shall never find. There is no solace on earth for us, for such as we, who search for a hidden city that we shall never see. Only the road and the dawn, the sun, the wind, and the rain, and the watchfire under stars, and sleep, and the road again. We seek the city of God and the haunt where beauty dwells, and we find the noisy mart and the sound of burial bells. Never the golden city where radiant people meet, but the dolorous town where mourners are going about the street. We travel the dusty road till the light of the day is dim, and sunset shows us spires away on the world's rim. We travel from dawn to dusk till the day is past and by, seeking the holy city beyond the rim of the sky. Friends and loves we have none, nor wealth, nor blessed abode, but the hope of the city of God at the other end of the road. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For information on Seekers, please go to our website at ttbook.org, or you can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at ttbook1. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our theme music today, you're listening to it now, was a listener remix by Christopher Bocast. If you'd like to try, the rules are all on the front of our website at ttbook.org. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Anne Strainchamps. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.